My name is Joe. I'm the pastor here. It's good that you can be with us. We are in our Hebrews series. We've been making our way through this letter, which we have been saying is a lot more like a sermon. We have seen lots about Jesus and how amazing he is and what faith in him is all about. And we continue that this morning by looking at a kind of mystery man character of the Bible, a guy with a name that is a bit of a mouthful as well. Melchizedek is his name. We're going to have a little bit of a look at him, but more so a look at Jesus and what he has to say to us this morning. So if you want to turn in your Bibles to Hebrews chapter 7, if you've got one of the black Bibles in front of you, you can follow along from page 1004. And we're going to read all of chapter 7. So make sure you follow along and we'll get stuck in. Hebrews chapter 7. For this Melchizedek, king of Salem, priest of the Most High God, met Abraham, returning from the slaughter of the kings, and blessed him. And to him, Abraham apportioned a tenth part of everything. He is first, by translation of his name, King of Righteousness. And then he is also King of Salem, that is, King of Peace. He is without father or mother or genealogy, having neither beginning of days nor end of life. But resembling the Son of God, he continues a priest forever. See how great this man was, to whom Abraham the patriarch gave a tenth of the spoils. And those descendants of Levi who received the priestly office have a commandment in the law to take tithes from the people, that is, from their brothers, though these also are descended from Abraham. But this man, who does not have his descent from them, received tithes from Abraham and blessed him who had the promises. It is beyond dispute that the inferior is blessed by the superior. In the one case, tithes are received by mortal men, but in the other case, by one of whom it is testified that he lives. One might even say that Levi himself, who received tithes, paid tithes through Abraham, for he was still in the loins of his ancestor when Melchizedek met him. Now, if perfection had been attainable through the Levitical priesthood, for under it the people received the law, what further need would there have been for another priest to arrive after the order of Melchizedek? Rather, than one named after the order of Aaron. For when there is a change in the priesthood, this is necessarily a change in the law as well. For the one of whom these things are spoken belonged to another tribe, from which no one has ever served at the altar. For it is evident that our Lord was descended from Judah, and in connection with that tribe, Moses said nothing about priests. This becomes even more evident when another priest arises in the likeness of Melchizedek, who has become a priest not on the basis of a legal requirement concerning bodily descent, but by the power of an indestructible life. For it is witnessed of him, "You are priests forever after the order of Melchizedek." For on the one hand, a former commandment is set aside because of its weakness and uselessness, for the law made nothing perfect. But on the other hand, a better hope is introduced through which we draw near to God. And is not without an oath, for those who formerly became priests were made such without an oath. But this one was made a priest with an oath by the one who said to him, "The Lord has sworn and will not change his mind. You are a priest forever." This makes Jesus the guarantor of a better covenant. The former priests were many in number because they were prevented by death from continuing in office. But he holds his priesthood permanently because he continues forever. Consequently, he is able to save to the uttermost those who draw near to God through him, since he always lives to make intercession for them. For it was indeed fitting that we should have such a high priest, holy, innocent, unstained, separated from sinners, and exalted above the heavens. He has no need, like those high priests, to offer sacrifices daily, first for his own sins and then for the sins of the people, since he did this once for all when he offered up himself. For the law appoints men in their weakness as high priests, but the word of the oath, which came later than the law, appoints a son who has been made perfect forever. Okay, thanks for bearing with me through that. It's a big story. Something that struck me during the recent American elections and the flood of social media commentary that followed in its wake was the tendency of humanity to blindly embrace a system and everything it stands for, regardless of what may be true or not. In the same breath, on my Facebook feed, there was a Trump supporter posting some article about how Trump is awesome, how he's going to do this amazing thing, and he's going to change everything, and it's about time. And then directly following it was an anti-Trump protester saying Trump's going to do something and he's been sprung and he'll be disqualified from ever being president. They'll have to kick him out of the job. And when you read both articles, it was just clear that both were just hype. None of them were based on truth. They were based on speculation. They were based on just pure rubbish, hopefulness that their idea might be proved to be true. And these are people that I know. These are people that are sensible people. They're not people who are prone to sensationalism. But the thing is, they swallowed their party's system, whether it's left or whether it's right. And so whatever their party was putting out, or whatever people connected to their party was putting out, they felt obliged to share. They felt like this must be the truth. This must be what is real. This is definitely going to happen because my system has told me it's going to happen. And so easily as humans, we get trapped into a system where we make decisions, we think through ideas, we learn how to think about the world through the lens of this system, and we rarely question it. If our system has declared this to be the way we should go, then that is the way we should go. Very rarely do we question that. And I reckon the main reason for this is because we're lazy, or maybe too busy, or maybe we just don't have the energy, or maybe we think we don't have the intellect to actually think through every issue that comes up in public debate and make a decision based on what we think is reasonable and right. It's very hard to do that on every single issue. It's very messy because sometimes you might come out on one side of one debate and the completely opposite side of another debate. It can get really messy to think through all of this. And so it's just easier for us to say, well, whatever the left says, I'll agree with them. Whatever the right says, I'll agree with them. It's just so much easier to fit into the system and do whatever the system says. Whether they knew it or not, the Jewish Christians who were the first to hear these words that we read this morning grew up as part of a system. The system of Judaism. A system that would have provided great comfort to them as they grew, direction for them, generation upon generation. They would have known how to engage with their world because of the system of Judaism. They would have known what to think about God and other things, big important issues, because the system would have told them how to think. And if you want to understand the book of Hebrews, you need to realize that the congregation of people that this is written to had undergone a significant change of system. See, these people were no longer Jews, no longer under the system of Judaism, but they had become followers of Jesus. And the longer they were in this new system of Jesus following, the greater the difference between their old life in Judaism seemed to them. The new system was actually calling them to leave much of the old system behind, a call that would have no doubt made them uncomfortable. It would have been uneasy for them to embrace new things, uneasy for them to leave part of their old life behind. The new system was calling them on, and it would have made them uncomfortable. And as we've seen throughout this series so far, there was also significant pressure on the people who were embracing this change from the people who hadn't embraced the change, from the people who were still back in the old system of Judaism, calling these people to say, hang on a minute, why don't you come back to Judaism? Come back to what you know. Come back to what you grew up in. Come back to what is familiar and comfortable for you. Because see, embracing the new system meant that persecution had come into their life. That their lives were under threat. Their way of life was under threat. And so their Jewish brothers were saying, come back. Come back to the comfort. Come back to the system that you know. We'll tell you what to think. We'll tell you how to engage with this world. You'll be safe here. You'll be fine. But the preacher's goal has been to call the people to see that only in this new system of following Jesus could they find the peace, the joy, and the hope that they deeply desired. And so once again this morning, the preacher will give what is one of the clearest comparisons of these two systems, calling the people to wrestle with which system they want to be a part of. Now, while we don't have the same emotional connection towards the system of Judaism that these people did, we need to realize that there are systems in our life that we so easily embrace. Systems that seek to guide and govern our lives. Systems that promise hope and joy and peace. And it's not just political systems of the right system and the left system. It's systems of friendship groups and the way that our friends would like to go in life. And we feel compelled to join our culture in that direction. It may be the system that our parents raised us within. A system that says, you know, generally most parents say things like, work hard, study hard, get a good job, get a good career, get the things that are important in place. Whatever it is, there are systems that guide and govern the direction we take in life. And we need to realize that these systems also need to be compared with the system of following Jesus. And so we need this message just as much as they did, because we need to see our systems held up against Jesus and following Jesus so that we might have even greater confidence to leave the brokenness of our systems behind and embrace His. The comparison begins with a character whom we've already seen little snippets about throughout this series so far, but to many of us stands as the quintessential biblical man of mystery, Melchizedek. Melchizedek only has one scene, a little cameo role in the book of Genesis, in the story of God's people. Just one little snippet, a few verses in one story in the scope of the entire Old Testament, we find Melchizedek. He comes in Genesis chapter 14. And the setting of the story is such that Abram had trusted God's call in his life. God had said, Abram, leave the home of your father. Leave all your stuff behind. Get up and move to the land that I am calling you to. And God promises to Abram that he's going to make him a great nation. He's going to give him descendants that are as numerous as the stars in the sky and the sand on the shore, that he'll give him a land to live in, that he'll make him a blessing to all the nations, that God's promise would dwell with him, presence would dwell with him forever, that Abraham was going to be a special guy, the father of a great nation. And so Abram trusted this promise, followed God to this land of Canaan, and he set up life there. His cousin Lot had come with him. And at one point they separate, and Lot takes the plain lands down near the towns of Sodom and Gomorrah, and Abraham stays in the region of Hebron. Well, what happens at one point is there's this powerful king, and this powerful king has control of the plain land regions, and he has lots of other kings who've allied themselves with him, and he basically goes to town wasting all the kings of the plain land region. He captures their cities, he takes their people and their property as plunder, and he goes and celebrates the spoils of his victory. Well, as part of that, he took Lot, Abram's cousin. He took him captive and he held him, probably to cast him into slavery. Abram hears about this, not happy. And so he bands together just 318 men, and they go against this great powerful king and all the kings that had allied with him. They go against him at night. He divides his forces, comes in, and God gives him a miraculous victory over this powerful king. And so Abraham comes back through the plain lands, victorious, bringing with him all that had been taken away from these people. And he's returning it all to them. And he brings with him his cousin Lot as well. And it's here, when he is returning from this battle, carrying the spoils of his victory, that he is met by our mystery man, Melchizedek. This is what it says of this encounter in Genesis chapter 14, verses 18 to 20. And Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought out bread and wine. He was priest of God Most High, and blessed him and said, "Blessed be Abram by God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth, and blessed be God Most High, who has delivered your enemies into your hands." And Abram gave him a tenth of everything. And it's this event that the preacher wants his people to reflect on. And specifically, he wants him to reflect on this mysterious character of Melchizedek. In the first three verses of Hebrews chapter 7, the preacher makes four incredibly bold statements about this man of mystery, Melchizedek. Firstly, he says that he is both priest and king. This is a rare combination in the story of God's people. In fact, priests and kings, the two roles, were deliberately separated from one another. There was this idea that the king was supposed to lead, and this king was supposed to lead his people into battle. He was supposed to do the dirty work, so to speak, of leading the people of God. He had to get his hands dirty, roll up his sleeves, get into the action, and lead his people bravely into battle. But the priest was supposed to be a man of clean hands, a man who served God, a man who listened to the voice of God, who interceded for the people before God. And so the role of king and priest was supposed to be separate. But here we have Melchizedek, who is both priest and king. It is a rare combination in the story of God's people. Secondly, his name carries significant meaning. Our names don't tend to carry much meaning. That's not how we name people. Maybe some of us do, but largely we get a name because it sounds nice, or our parents liked it, or maybe it was someone in our family who had that name, and we like to carry that tradition on. There isn't much sense that we look up the meaning of names and hope that our child will embrace the meaning of that name. But in cultures like Judaism, you were named for a specific purpose. You were named because your parents hoped that you would embrace the character of that name. Names carried incredible meaning. Kind of some people in our culture might name a child based on a character that they hope the child will have. Like you see children named Faith or Hope or Charity in this sense that maybe the child will embrace these concepts. It's kind of good that we didn't have this ideal, or I think I would have had three children called Olympian, Fast Bowler and Professional Golfer. That's probably what I would have gone for. But no, in this culture here of Judaism, people were named for a reason. Melchizedek's name, by translation, means King of Righteousness. King of Righteousness. And his title, the King of Salem or Jerusalem, actually means King of Peace. There's deep meaning invested in this guy's name. He's not just any old king. He's the King of Righteousness and the King of Peace. Thirdly, he has no record of genealogy or origin. Knowing someone's lineage was an important part of building reputation in this culture. To know who their father and grandfather was important. You know what tribe they came from, what clan they came from. It was important. But here there's nothing of this mystery man's history known at all. This leads the preacher to declare that he has neither beginning of days nor end of life. That's a pretty bold claim. Now, I don't know whether this guy is speaking in terms of he's just this dude who arrived out of nowhere. I think he's more saying that that's not important. His origin is not important in this discussion. His end of life is not important in the discussion. What's important is who he is and what he does. And fourthly, finally, he resembles the Son of God. In fact, the idea that he resembles the internal priesthood of the Son of God. So think about what we have here in this man. We have a priest of the Most High God who is also a king, the King of Righteousness and Peace, who reigns from Jerusalem and resembles the Son of God. And he comes out and serves Abram bread and wine. And Abram gives him a tithe, a tenth of all his spoils. The preacher has deliberately highlighted Melchizedek to cement his importance to the Hebrews. And here's his point. Verse 4. See how great this man was, to whom Abram, the patriarch, gave a tenth of his spoils. And verse 7, it is beyond dispute that the inferior is blessed by the superior. The preacher is elevating this guy Melchizedek into what can only be described as a lofty position. He's making out that Melchizedek is greater than Abraham, greater than the greatest figure in the history of God's people. And if he's greater than Abram, he's certainly greater than the Levitical priests who came after him. Look at verse 5. And those descendants of Levi who received the priestly office have a commandment in the law to take tithes from the people, that is, from their brothers, though these also are descended from Abraham. But this man who does not have his descent from them received tithes from Abraham and blessed him who had the promises. Verse 9, one might say that Levi himself, who receives tithes, paid tithes through Abraham, for he was still in the loins of his ancestor when Melchizedek met him. Melchizedek stands not only as this kind of man of mystery in one small encounter in God's story, but here we're told he's like one of the greatest characters, despite his incredibly brief appearance. If Abraham is top dog in Jewish thinking, then what is the man who blesses him? If priests and kings play vital roles in the story, then what is the man who is both priest and king? If Moses' anointing of Levi's tribe as priest was significant, then what of the man who acted as a priest to Levi's great-grandfather? Melchizedek stands as the archetype of a kind of priesthood that is not derived from bloodline, that is greater than the Levitical priesthood because it was before it, and is even greater than the man at the very center of the Jewish faith, greater than Abraham. And it's this Melchizedekian priestly tradition that the preacher declares that Jesus is the greatest example of. In verse 17, again, he cites Psalm 110. For it is witnessed of him, you are a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. Making this the fourth time that he's either quoted or referenced this passage. For the Jews, Psalm 110 stood as the promise that when the Messiah came, it would not be to reestablish the old Levitical system, but to supersede it, to embrace something greater, the greater priestly order of Melchizedek. Clearly, the preacher is targeting those who are thinking of departing Christianity and heading back to Judaism. It's if he's saying, would you go back to the old priesthood when there is a greater one available? The greater priesthood that we have all been waiting for. The priest who comes after the order of Melchizedek, the man greater than Abraham. But it's not just the greatness of the Melchizedekian priesthood that the preacher is concerned with. It's significant problems with the old Levitical system that also needed to be explained. And so to do this, in verses 11 to 28, the preacher compares and contrasts the old system with the new system. The old Levitical system with this awesome, greater Melchizedekian priesthood system. And there are three points of comparison that we're going to look at this morning. Look at verses 11 and 12. Now, if perfection had been attainable through the Levitical priesthood, for under it the people received the Lord, what further need would there have been for another priest to arise after the order of Melchizedek, rather than one named after the order of Aaron? For when there is a change in the priesthood, there is necessarily a change in the law as well. This old Levitical system of priests was the single most important part of Jewish life. It was how the people remained in fellowship with God, how they made atonement for their sins. Yet here the preacher declares that it was a system that was fundamentally broken. Perfection was not attainable through the Levitical priesthood. While God had given the people this system to facilitate their worship of him, time and time and time again, the people proved that the system was broken, that the system could never perfectly fix their problem of sin. It covered their sin for a season, but it never removed it altogether. The people still lived under a system of guilt and fear. Every time they sinned, there was guilt, and they needed to go to the priest. They needed to make amends. They needed to bring the sacrifice. They needed to make atonement. Every single time, there was never any permanent solution to their problem, never any perfection. Hence the prophecies in Psalm 110 of another priest who was to come, a priest from outside of the broken system, a priest in the order of Melchizedek. The preacher asks, why would God say another type of priest was coming if the original system worked perfectly? We often say, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Likewise, God would not send a fix for something that did not need to be fixed. The Jews were clinging to a broken system, and they were calling the Jewish Christians to come back to that same broken system. But the preacher is calling to his people in verse 18. For on the one hand, a former commandment is set aside because of its weakness and uselessness, for the Lord made nothing perfect. But on the other hand, a better hope is introduced, through which we draw near to God. The old system, the Levitical priesthood, and the law that governed it were weak and useless. It had been set aside by God when he sent something far greater, a new priesthood that would actually do what the old one never could, bring us to God. See, think about it. Under the old system of priests, were people ever really brought to God? No. They had to stop. They had to stop at the edge of the tent. They had to stop at the edge of the Holy of Holies. And only the priest could go in and be in God's presence and make atonement for sin. Only the priest could do that. And so if you followed your priest under the old Levitical system, you followed them right to the very fringe of the presence of God, but you were not allowed in. You were never truly brought to God. You were just brought to the fringe of where God was. But here, in this new system under Jesus, this new system in the order of Melchizedek, the preacher tells us that Jesus does what the old system never could. It brings us into the very presence of God. And this is the first big comparison between the two systems. The old priesthood brought us to the fringe of God's presence, and only for a temporary stay. It was like a night in a 6-star hotel. You were there and it was great, but it was only for one night. And then you were gone again. And you had to find a priest and come back again just to the fringe. But the new priesthood of Jesus perfects us and brings us right into the very presence of God forever. It's like a 28-star hotel. You're right in there and you're in there forever. That's your new permanent home. The two systems. One brings you to the fringe for a short stay, and one takes you into the very center for all of eternity. The first comparison between the two systems. One of the strange things that the preacher highlights about Melchizedek is that he seems to have no beginning or end. From this he declares that Melchizedek stands as a priest forever. Now by this he doesn't mean that Melchizedek kind of lives forever or that he's some sort of spirit, but that he's his kind of priesthood endures forever. Because his was the first priesthood before Abram. And when Jesus comes in this same order, it's like Melchizedek's priesthood is stretching from before Abraham right through, over the top of the Levitical priesthood and into where Jesus arrives. And in that time, that middle section that Melchizedek's priesthood spans over the top of, that Levitical system, in that time, we're told that there were countless priests. Priest after priest after priest after priest, for generation upon generation. But over the top of all that is just this one man, Melchizedek, who had this original priesthood, and it exists all the way until Jesus comes in the New Testament. Verse 23, the former priests were many in number because they were prevented by death from continuing in the office. In other words, the Levitical priests came and went, limited by the span of their own lives. But in verse 24, he tells us that Jesus holds his priesthood permanently because he continues forever. Consequently, he is able to save to the utmost those who draw near to God through him, since he always lives to make intercession for them. Jesus taps into this Melchizedekian priesthood of old and continues in that tradition forever. We have to remember that in a couple of weeks, we celebrate the death and resurrection of Jesus. That Jesus died but rose from the dead, conquered the grave, and he lives forever at the right hand of God in heaven. That Jesus went into death and came out the other side triumphant. That Jesus lives forever. And so unlike all those old priests who lived their life, served faithfully, but then died, unable to continue their priesthood, Jesus exists forever. He lives forever. And do you know what he's living forever to do? You know what Jesus is doing right at this very minute? He's interceding for you and me. Jesus, right now, continuing his priestly ministry. Jesus sees you in your life and he intercedes for you. He pleads to his Father on your behalf. He makes atonement for your sin. See, so often we get this picture in our heads that I come to Jesus, I receive forgiveness for sin, but then I still struggle with sin. And that sin, it grips me with guilt, it crushes me, and I feel like I need to come to Jesus all over again. And I just feel like I'm trapped in this cycle. Jesus became your priest. Jesus became your priest when you put your trust in him, and he continues to be your priest forever. Right now, Jesus is standing at the right hand of the Father in heaven, and he's acting as your priest. He's interceding for you. He's made atonement for your sin, and he continues to intercede on your behalf. Your sin is forgiven because your priest continues to minister. Your priest continues to serve you, and he lives for it. He lives to make intercession for all who have put their faith in him. Here's the comparison, the second comparison. The old priestly system is nothing but a constant stream of priests who are only ever as effective as the length of their lives. But the new priesthood of Jesus lives forever because he lives forever and continually is interceding for his people, and that's what he lives for. Jesus stands at the right hand of the Father and continually pleads my case. That is stunning in and of itself. Along with the many priests that lived and died during the time of the Levitical system, there were also countless sacrifices that were made. Countless lambs, goats, bulls, and birds that were all slaughtered daily at the temple to cover the people's sins. See, because this system was imperfect, because it only covered sin rather than erasing it completely, people and their priests were bound to the system. Day by day, week by week, month by month, year by year, they had to keep going back to make atonement for their sins all over again. The Levitical priesthood was kind of like a dialysis treatment for sin. You know, where people get dialysis work done on their kidneys, kidney is failing, go to the hospital over and over and over again. Yes, dialysis works, but you're bound to keep returning to the hospital, bound to keep coming back over and over again, because the minute you miss a treatment, you are in serious trouble. But the preacher declares that Jesus is not dialysis. Jesus is like a kidney transplant for our sin problem. Verse 26, "For it was indeed fitting that we should have such a high priest, holy, innocent, unstained, separated from sinners, and exalted above the heavens. He has no need, like those high priests, to offer sacrifices daily, first for his own sins and then for those of the people. Since he did this once for all when he offered himself up." See, instead of offering up an imperfect animal after imperfect animal, Jesus offered the one thing that would completely deal with our sin problem. He offered himself. Jesus was the perfect priest, but he was also the perfect sacrifice. Jesus' death was not the unfortunate end to the life of a revolutionary shut down by the oppressors. Jesus' death was a sacrifice beyond compare. He was holy, innocent, unstained, separated from sinners, and exalted above the heavens. And yet he offered that life, that holy, innocent, unstained, separated above the heavens life, he offered that as a perfect sacrifice for our sin. So often, anything good we get, we don't want to give up. And if we attain to the job that we want, we don't want to quit from it. If we achieve a certain level of sporting success, we want to stay there. We want to hold it. If we achieve a certain level of financial security, well, we want to keep it. Whatever good we attain, we want to hold on to. Well, Jesus was holy, innocent, unstained, separated from sinners, and exalted above the heavens. He had everything. He was perfect in every way. Yet instead of holding on to it, he offered it up as a sacrifice. Not for his benefit, but for yours. For your benefit and for mine. Jesus' death was the offering up of a sacrifice beyond compare. And here's the third comparison. The old priesthood could never completely deal with sin. It was nothing more than a band-aid solution, a treatment that needed to be repeated over and over and over again with never any real satisfaction. But the new priesthood of Jesus is based on a once-for-all sacrifice of his own perfect life to completely cleanse and erase our sin problem. Jesus looks at the old dialysis treatment of the Levitical system and says, nah, I've got a brand new kidney for you. I'm going to fix the problem permanently and you'll never have to keep coming back again. I'm going to do it once for all. You'll never have to keep coming back again. And so here's the deal. The Levitical priesthood only temporarily brought people to the fringe of God's presence. But in Jesus, we have one who leads us right into the very presence of God forever. The Levitical priesthood was limited to the length of a priest's life, required an endless stream of priests to serve. But in Jesus, we have one who lives forever to intercede for us forever. And the Levitical priesthood could never, ever completely cure our sin. It was a treatment that needed to be reapplied over and over again. But in Jesus, we have the once-for-all cure for sin, completely erased, completely gone, completely taken away. The preacher wanted to make it clear. For Jewish Christians, to go back into Judaism meant moving from the center to the fringe of God's presence. Meant going back to searching for a priest to keep on interceding for them. To keep looking and looking to find someone who might be able to help them. And it meant going back to the long and tiring slog of offering up daily, weekly, monthly, yearly sacrifices instead of embracing the once for all sacrifice of Christ. The preacher is making it clear. Why would you go back to the fringe when you can be in the center? Why would you go back to searching for a priest when you have one who lives forever to intercede for you? Why would you go back to those daily, weekly, monthly, yearly sacrifices when you have a once for all sacrifice in Jesus? Why would you go back? Now, I know none of us here this morning are probably going to head out and find a synagogue and a Levitical priest to start offering sacrifices for us. It's just probably not going to happen. That's not where we're going to be tempted to leave Jesus to. But I reckon many of us are looking for a system. Many of us are looking by a system that we can live by. A system by which we can make sense of our lives and offer us hope. We don't call that system a priesthood, but in many ways, they function just like them. I just got three here that I thought of. The system of the great Australian dream. This is a narrative that governs so much of so many people in Australia's lives. It's told to us from generations back. The great Australian dream. You are a hard-working, good mate to people. You earn enough money to buy your little piece of Australia and you set up your home there and you have your 2.3 kids and your marriage. You have your two Holden cars in the driveway or probably the carport with one of those doors that goes up. That'd be really, really nice. And you build a big nest egg of superannuation so that you can retire as early as possible and live out the rest of your days in comfort and still leave a really nice inheritance for your children after you. That's the great Australian dream. Permanence, a home, stability, financial security. That is a dream that governs and guides so many lives, so many lives. But it's a broken dream. It's a dream that can never work perfectly. Because even when you get there, even if you manage to get that entire package completely together, you would still feel unsatisfied. You would still be searching for something else. You'd still be looking for more. Still be looking for that next great dream. What about the great global citizen dream? I think my generation, probably generations younger than me, are sick of the great Australian dream. The idea of permanence, staying in one place, no thank you. I want to see this world. Why have an Australian dream when you can have a global one? I want to live and work in London. I want to travel through Southeast Asia. I want to do Europe. I want to see as much of this world as possible. And so you get a job that's incredibly transferable, that you can work anywhere, or you're just prepared to do any job anywhere, fruit picking, whatever it happens to be. You go and you do it, and you travel the world as much as you possibly can, chasing experience after experience, wanting to be that person that has that awesome selfie picture in every great location across the world, flooded all over your Facebook and Instagram streams. You want to be that global citizen. You want to embrace as much of this world as you possibly can. But it's a broken dream. It's a broken system. It costs a lot of money to do that, to start with. Kind of unsustainable in the long run. And then there's deep longings that we have that can't be lived out while you're traveling all around the world. Longings for deep relationship, longings for community and a home, a sense of permanence. Longings for a family that's hard to have while you're traveling all around the world. There's so many other things that can't be fulfilled by the global citizen dream. What about the great spiritual experience dream, where you chase down as many spiritual experiences as you can, taking a bit and a piece of every religion, every ideology known to mankind? You'll embrace the meditation of yoga. You'll embrace the pilgrimage to some holy temple in Southeast Asia. You'll embrace practices of mindfulness and wellness. Whatever it is, you'll chase it down. You'll eat, pray, and love your way around this dream, trying to capture as much outside of yourself spirituality as possible. But it's a broken dream. It's a broken system. It can never truly fulfill you. And we know that because we're constantly adding another spiritual experience on top of it. What this one couldn't give me, maybe this one will. See, time and time again, whatever system we embrace, we either get locked into it so tight that we can't see anything else, and we can't see the fact that it's crushing us, or we get locked into something that just never fulfills us, never satisfies us. And we want to break out of that system and find another one. And we're constantly on the search for the next experience, the next country, the next thing that will help us, or thing that will satisfy us, the next relationship, whatever it happens to be. These systems that we embrace break us and crush us and trap us. The problem with living in these systems, these priesthood, is exactly the same problems with the Levitical priesthood. They only ever give us a taste of the divine and never the full meal. They are never permanent. They always keep changing on us. and they force us to keep working and striving to stay connected to them. I don't know about you, but I'm sick of striving. Sick of striving to meet up with some system that's guiding and governing my life. I'm sick of it. How can I possibly strive and work for something that never makes me feel like I've permanently arrived and never actually gives me the full meal, but only just a little taste? In Jesus, the great high priest, the priest whose origin extends right back past all other priesthoods to this idea of Melchizedek, the original priest king. Jesus, our priest king, who offers himself as the once for all sacrifice for our sin. Jesus, who lives forever to intercede for me at the right hand of the Father. And Jesus, who brings me right into the presence of the Father forever. He gives me permanence. He gives me the fullness of God. And he liberates me from having to work to please him. Jesus is far better and far greater than any system that you could ever embrace in this world. And he is far greater than any system of religion like Judaism of the past. Jesus gives you permanence. Jesus gives you presence of God. And Jesus liberates you from having to please God. Jesus gives you everything that you could ever need. And the call of the preacher here is to leave your broken system behind and embrace the Jesus who gives you everything. And I would call you to investigate this Jesus this morning as well. Let's pray. Father, I want to thank you. I want to thank you that you have shown us clearly what difference Jesus makes to this world. Lord, I want to acknowledge that so many of us, all of us, at one time or another, embraces a broken system. A system that crushes us, a system that betrays us, a system that never really gives us what we're searching for. And Lord, I want to thank you that you have given us Jesus. Jesus who can bring us right into your presence. Jesus who can give us a sense of permanence that he is always there interceding for us, always working for our good. And Jesus who offered himself, his perfect self, as a sacrifice for our sin once for all, so that we don't have to keep going back and striving to please you. Lord, I want to thank you for the fact that Jesus is far greater than any other system in this world. And I pray that we might be able to see the bankruptcy of our systems and cling to Jesus above everything else. In whose name we pray. Amen.